Religion is personal. But it's public too, and sometimes painfully so. It can unite, it can also divide, and the British played that card like pros, twisting faith to keep control. Gods and Empire, a story of power, faith, and control. He's here to uncover how religion became a tool of conquest and what it means today.
Hello.
How are you? How lovely you look.
This is our traditional Kerala attire.
Beautiful.
Action.
He's made millions rethink what they were taught. He may just do that to you today, Dr. Shashi Tharoor.
Welcome. Hi, Ranjan. How are you?
Very good. So our episode today is called Gods, and which is why I think it would be fair for me to ask you this question. People are online, they are bugged. They want to know if British really misunderstood Hinduism, or was it their plan all along?
No, actually, they wanted to understand. See, the thing about colonialism is, when you come and conquer a place, at least the British wanted to know as much about it as they could. But what they got was not necessarily a truly accurate reflection of the lived reality. It was what they thought it should be. Now, for example, William Jones, who was a very genuine Orientalist before it became a bad word, somebody who was interested in Asia and the Orient, took the trouble to learn Sanskrit, learn Persian. He was very serious about his discovery of the region. He said, you know, we've got to find out what these Hindu laws are. So he called a bunch of Brahmins together because he assumed that only Brahmins knew all of this. And they wrote something called the Code of Gentoo Laws in the 1790s. And this basically, obviously, was self-interested. It was about depicting the Brahmins as the king of the walks, as you know, in charge of everything, the top caste in the hierarchy, the people who had to be deferred to for everything, who had got all the key positions, etc., which may or may not have been entirely true, but this is what the British then believed was the way to proceed. And you saw this very frequently, as I mentioned in another episode. The map, the census, the writing of laws, the categorization, the understanding of the caste system, everything was part of the colonial desire to categorize and control through understanding. Now, that doesn't mean that that was necessarily bad. It was about, for them, it was about control. But it was an effort, some degree, to understand. But there were also the snooty, racist colonialists who were not bothered to understand. A classic example is Macaulay. Macaulay, who came and said that all the learning of Arabia, Persia, and India is not worth a single shelf of English books. How did he know that? He didn't know Arabic, Persian, or any Indian language. He hadn't read any of these things. He was just convinced that his racial superiority was such that all that mattered was this one shelf of English books. That kind of attitude was also there. And part of the problem with British understanding was that they saw us through their prism. So I often joke about the three M's in the 19th century who did so much to distort the perception of what India was all about. There was Mill, who wrote a history of India without knowing India, and who categorized Indian history into sort of an evolutionary thing of three periods, the Hindu period, the Muslim period, the British period. You know, this was Mill, John Stuart Mill's contribution to the understanding of India. Then you had Macaulay with his snooty, sneering contempt for everything to do with Indian practices, Indian religion, Indian culture, Indian education, all of that. And then you had Max Müller, who is a German Anglophile, I mean, he wrote in English and somewhere he was of German origin, who came up with ideas that got very entrenched in the court. For example, this entire notion of the Aryan race. It was partially based on linguistics. It was the idea that, in fact, even William Jones, 50 years before Max Müller, had theorized that the similarities between Sanskrit, Latin, and Greek could not be purely coincidental, that maybe they derived from a common origin. Max Müller codified this into the idea of the Indo-European linguistic family and the Aryan race as the embodiment of it. Now, this was contested and argued because obviously many racists didn't like the idea that Indians and Europeans were from the same race, the Aryan race. Others, of course, in India would often embrace this kind of thing. Some Europeans said, well, maybe they were once the same origin, but the Indians have degenerated and we are now superior. So all of this nonsense went on as well. But these people kind of framed a certain understanding. And then there was a fourth M, another fellow who knew nothing about India, never visited, didn't have a clue, Karl Marx, who came up with this theory of Oriental despotism. And ironically, because everyone thinks of him as this iconoclastic, radical sort of, you know, theorist, he actually wrote justifying British colonialism because he felt that Oriental despotism and the evils of Indian rule and the way in which our country thing were being remedied by British colonialism. So if you want, the shaping of the perceptions of India by four M's are all really worth pointing the finger at with some despair.
What about the British and other Europeans trying to convert people into Christianity? Was it forced or was it more low-key? Also, tell us whether the British were really interested in religion or was this all about politics?
Actually, it's all very complicated. To begin with, the original sort of colonial impulses of the British were different from theirs, for example, of the Spanish. When the Spanish went off to Latin America, it was explicitly in the service of God to convert the heathens, to bring the light of Christianity to the people of Latin America. So this was very much the core mission. For the British, they came to India to make money. In fact, they were so clear about that, that they did not encourage priests to come to India. You will not believe this. The British have been around since 1614 when the first British embassy came to visit Emperor Jahangir. It was only in the 1820s that the first British bishop was allowed to set foot. For 200 years, the British were openly about making money, exploitation, loot, and they did not want morality and priests coming and lecturing them. In fact, if you read the texts of those days, the early critics of the East India Company and their misadventures were, in fact, religious leaders in England who thought it was immoral what the British were doing in India. And by the beginning of the 19th century, therefore, the narrative changed. Now, these priests who came, they had another challenge with India. Those who came to Kerala, and this is not just the British, the Portuguese before them, were stunned to discover they were Christians there already. Because Christianity had come to Kerala at the time of Christ. St. Thomas the Apostle, Doubting Thomas, was supposed to have landed on the shores of Kerala around 52 AD and converted a lot of people to Christianity. 1800 years after Christianity first came, there were already flourishing Christian sects, and the British were teaching a new kind of Christianity, which is the Anglican Protestant version. Right, so the Portuguese have brought Catholicism. Before that, the original Orthodox Church had come and established itself. There were St. Thomas Christians following the so-called Mar Thoma tradition. And now you have the Anglican Protestants coming, the London Missionary Society. They then started converting. When you ask me, was this politics? Yes and no, because religious conversion has its own impulses. Did it have political benefits and implications? Obviously, yes. Because what had happened is that the local rulers had to make their peace with the new powers, the British colonials. So they would, for example, give land to churches and church groups. They would give other grants. Many of these churches, by the way, did good social service. That is, every church usually had a school attached. So education, particularly for people excluded from education before, like Dalit communities, became possible. The midday meals, we hear about them today as if they're a new invention. Middle of the 19th century in Kerala, these churches were giving midday meals to poor students so they could actually come to school to eat and stay on and learn. So all of these things are also happening.
Now, Shashi, you're also a member of parliament from Kerala. Tell us how Kerala, your constituency, became the symbol of religious harmony.
It really is quite remarkable. As I mentioned, we had the oldest diaspora of Jews, in fact, the only Jewish diaspora that never knew a single episode of anti-Semitism from the local population for the Jews in India. We had the Christians coming, as I mentioned to you. We had Islam. Now, how did Islam come? In the northern part of India, there is this perception that Islam came with the sword. They came as conquerors, fighters, often looters as well. In Kerala, that wasn't the case because, as I mentioned earlier, the Arabian Sea was so easy to cross that people from what is the Arab world had been coming and trading with Kerala since before the time of Christ. And what they would do is they would come when the monsoon winds brought the boats to Kerala. They would settle for a few months, often marry or have local spouses or whatever, trade, purchase. Then when the winds changed, they'd go back. And every year they'd come. And this was literally going on for centuries before Islam. So what happened was Islam came to Kerala, not at all by the sword, but as news. The same people you're used to seeing coming every year are suddenly telling, hey, you know what's happening in our country? There's this prophet, and he's saying all of this stuff. It became so interesting that one of our local kings, a man called Chiraman Perumal, decided he wanted to go to Mecca and meet the prophet. Now, we don't know whether he actually met the prophet. He got onto a ship. There was a whole flotilla of 22, 23 ships that headed off for Arabia, many of which didn't make it past Lakshadweep or all the Maldives. But there is one fascinating proof of his journey, which is that even today, in Oman, south of the port of Salalah, there are Kerala coconut trees growing on the coast, which are not native to the Arabian Peninsula. And the legend is these were coconuts taken by Chiraman Perumal to sustain himself during the journey. When he got there, the spare ones were planted in the Arabian soil. Isn't that a fascinating story? Then, so you have Islam as well. And don't forget that as the Arabian world converts to Islam, these traders who were coming and who kept on coming were now Muslims. So there were suddenly, the old Arabs were now Muslims settling and coming and going. And there was a lot of intermixing. In fact, the intermixing is so extensive that I've read an article from a geneticist who says that genetically, it is impossible to separate the population of Oman from the population of coastal Kerala. Kerala, therefore, as you say, has become a kind of poster child for pluralism because all these communities have coexisted and they have done so in harmony for so long. We're talking 3,000 years. Even more strikingly is that let's face it, in India, we have lots of religious festivals and they're all identified with specific communities, with a particular religion, or even a particular religion in a particular state, right? So Karwa Chauth, North Indian women only, or the Chhath Puja, maybe Bihari men, many do this kind of stuff. So in Kerala, we have a festival called Onam, which derives from an ancient legend, and therefore is Hindu in origin, but which is equally celebrated by all communities. It's a sort of combination of Christmas, Diwali, Holi, it's a festival where we're doing all the stuff you associate with those festivals. We buy gifts for each other, we have grand feasts, we wear new clothes, we do all of the stuff, and all communities do it. And I remember, for example, visiting the African country of Gambia, where our consul general, we had an honorary consul general, a businessman there, and I said, you can't have too many Indian families. The entire country of Gambia is two sides of a river. And the entire population is not even a million people or less, probably much less. So I said, you can't have too many. He said, oh, we have about 23 Indian families. In those days, I'm talking 20 years ago. So I said, oh, 23 Indian families. Any Malayalis? He said, oh, I think just two or three families. So I said, well, then you probably don't get hassled to get said to celebrate Onam every year as the Malayalis do wherever they are in the world. And he said, you've got to be kidding me. Of course, they insist that we should have an Onam celebration to which all the other Indians are invited. Does it tell me who are these Malayali families? There was a Christian family and a Muslim family. There wasn't even a Hindu family, and they were celebrating this great tradition.
Now, Shashi, people on the internet want to know what is the difference between politicized Hinduism and Hinduism as a way of life, especially from the perspective of Adi Shankaracharya, who happens to be, again, from Kerala.
So Adi Shankara is a very important figure in the history of Hinduism because what people forget is that Buddhism and to some degree Jainism had actually overtaken Hinduism from about 300 BC when Ashoka ruled most of the country and was himself Buddhist, right up to about the 7th century, 8th century AD. Buddhism and not Hinduism was dominant in many parts of India. Reason being that Buddhism had begun as a reform movement within Hinduism, And the Buddhist ways of life and worship and so on, including the monastery culture, all of that, had become widely entrenched. Hindus owe in many ways the revival and triumph of Hinduism to Adi Shankara. Because Adi Shankara, who left home at the age of 8 to go off and he was just a brilliant, brilliant scholar, go off and preach and argue and so on, he did 2 or 3 very important things. He developed a synthesis of the key elements of Hinduism. Hinduism, as I've mentioned earlier, had thousands of holy books. There were so many texts. It was a somewhat difficult mishmash for anyone to simply digest. Everyone says the Vedas, the holy books. The Vedas were just some of the holy books. You also had the Upanishads, you had the Gitas, you had the Puranas, you had so many different kinds. You had bhashyas or commentaries on various things. You had so much. It was Adi Shankara who said, I'm going to take the essential ones and focus on those. Second, it had become a very esoteric preserve of the Brahmin priestly elite. So for ordinary people, there was very, very little that they could relate to other than perhaps, you know, going to temples and praying. Adi Shankara brought in a lot of verses, stotrams, mantras that ordinary people could learn and recite and so on. So Adi Shankara popular, he also did one thing that is quite astonishing when you realize the primitive conditions of India in those days. He traveled the length and breadth of the country. From Kerala to Kashmir, from Gujarat to Assam, Adi Shankara's footprints are everywhere. And he established temples and mutts. To this day, in Srinagar, Kashmir, there is a Shankaracharya temple where the priests are Nambudris from Kerala even today. Because he had gone with these priests and their descendants and then, of course, reinfusions from the south. So you've got this amazing knitting together of the Hindu civilizational space by Adi Shankara. I give him the fullest credit for the revival of Hinduism. And with all these mutts, these temples coming up, Hinduism eclipsed Buddhism. But one of the things that happened, we took a lot from Buddhism. Certainly the importance of ahimsa and nonviolence was a Buddhist Jain contribution to Hindu philosophy, even though it was implicit, it was there. There were other reform movements. One amazing thing about Hinduism is it's never lacked in reformers. And Kerala, by the time you get to the late 19th century, had some of the most distinctive reformers imaginable. People who challenged the caste system, for example, which had become ossified.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Religion aside, what about caste? Because Kerala has had strong history of anti-caste movements as well. What would you say to people who still call Kerala casteist?
It was deeply casteist. It was so ridiculously ridden with caste discrimination that as late as the 1880s and 90s, when Swami Vivekananda visited Kerala, he described it as a lunatic asylum because the prohibitions were so absurd. There were literally specified distances that a Dalit had to keep from a Nayar or from a Brahmin. Literally, there were entire roads where only the upper caste could walk and the lower caste not allowed to step onto those roads. There were temples, of course, from which the lower castes were excluded. You had all sorts of prohibitions. And Vivekananda was astonished that human beings could treat other human beings in this appalling way. So there was a lot of this. But because there was that, there was also a resistance to it. And so you had scholars, thinkers, sages, spiritual leaders saying, we've got to challenge this. As far back as the early 19th century, there was Thaikkad Ayyar Vaswami, who challenged caste system, who encouraged people to dine together, which was unheard of before, that you couldn't have meals with people of lower caste. Then you have people like Mahatma Ayyankali, the great Dalit reformer, who challenged the prohibition against Dalits riding bullock carts or Dalits wearing turbans or Dalits going on certain roads by breaking all those prohibitions and challenging the authorities. Then you had, perhaps most famously, Sri Narayana Guru, who is in many ways considered perhaps the greatest. In fact, there was a poll of the greatest Keralite of the millennium by a major Malayalam newspaper in 2000 when the millennium was over. And Sri Narayana Guru won heads up, even ahead of Adi Shankara and others, because he reformed all of these practices. His famous slogan was, one caste, one God, one religion for all mankind. And he wanted people to look completely beyond these artificial distinctions. At the same time, though he did this within the fold of Hinduism, and Hinduism, therefore, in many ways, owes its survival and prosperity in Kerala to the fact that the existence of a reformer like Sri Narayana Guru meant that the lower castes whom he empowered no longer had a reason to go and convert to some other religion, because within their own religion they found empowerment and meaning. Even then, he had another famous line: it doesn't matter what your religion is as long as the man is good. So this whole business that humanity, humanism, should be part of the social reform movement also comes from Sri Narayana Guru.
I also want to ask you, did the British manage to pull off their divide and rule in Kerala?
Not entirely. It gets a bit complicated. Kerala, as I said, Muslims, Christians, Hindus coexisting for a long time. But there were inevitably distinctions. In the 1920s, there was something called the Maple Rebellion, where a large number of Muslims, smarting against British policies, rose up in arms. Now, there are various theories about what exactly happened. The sort of Marxist or leftist school of thought is it was essentially not a religious rebellion, but a peasant rebellion against landlords who happened to be Hindus, mainly Nayars, and the British. There's the other theory that it was a communal disturbance between Muslims and Hindus, whatever it was, and whether it was a direct result of British divide and rule or an indirect result. That was the one period in the 1920s where there was some fairly vicious communal violence. There has been no incident of communal tension. In fact, there have been some remarkable examples of the opposite. You remember when North India was really almost aflame with the destruction of the Babri Masjid, the principal Muslim religious leader in Kerala not only demanded that his followers not react, he ordered many of his followers to protect Hindu temples from any hot-headed Muslims who wanted reprisals because of Babri Masjid. Fascinating. There was no violence in Kerala after the Babri Masjid episode, even though in Mumbai, in many, many places across North India, there was. So Kerala, in many ways, was a paragon of communal harmony thereafter.
What about the Sabarimala controversy? The 2018 Sabarimala verdict, it basically declared the ban on women unconstitutional. Looking back from 1936, the temple entry proclamation to Sabarimala. Do you think that law helps, in a sense, to bind religion and politics, or does it complicate it?
Well, I can tell you that the Temple Entry Proclamation, which after all was an act of legislation, it was a legislative edict by the Maharaja of Travancore, that was an enormously influential change, because up to then, most temples were barred to the lower castes. It was the great Kerala artist Ravi Varma, Raja Ravi Varma, who had first started depicting Hindu gods in art, which was then using the newly invented lithograph printing press, printed for mass sale. So suddenly, even the lower castes who could not enter temples could have pictures of gods in their homes to worship. That kind of popularization also began in Kerala. So you have all these contradictions. Now, at the same time, there are very deeply entrenched traditions in every faith. So just as I was talking about the Catholic Church having its own rules, which no one challenges because they come from faith, similarly, Sabarimala, the story is that this particular deity, Lord Ayyappa, was a brahmachari who actually retreated into the Sabarimala temple in the forest, in the middle of the forest on top of a hill, and in part escaping an arranged marriage with his princess. In fact, there is a separate shrine to the princess some distance from the temple where you can actually have her looking longingly, as it were, towards him. So the custom is that anyone who goes to the Ayyappa temple in Sabarimala is a believer in this legend and therefore respects the prohibition that says that women of marriageable age, or in other words, menstruating women, so women from 10 to 50 essentially, should not go because it would be an offense to the sight of the deity. Now, this belief is so deeply entrenched that the logic is irrefutable when people say, and women have told me this, that any woman between 10 and 50 who goes is not a believer, because if she believes she will not want to go, it will be insult to the god. And those of us who believe we will not go till we're 50 will wait. Now, that's the kind of belief system there is. The other argument that is often made is if you want to worship Ayyappa, there are Ayyappa temples all over Kerala where this particular legend is not relevant. This legend only applies to the Sabarimala temple because it's the forest and the hill. But in this particular case, the judicial pronouncement by the court encountered so much resistance that the matter is still under review.
Now, there are so many beautiful stories from your constituency, from Kerala, Ophir being one of them.
Ah, yes.
Some were even challenged by colonialism. Was Ophir one of them?
Well, Ophir actually is legend going way back before colonialism. It's Puvar in my constituency that was Ophir. It was a very major port in the days before Christ. And there is a lovely British poem by John Masefield called Cargoes, which begins with a verse that goes like this. Quinquirem of Nineveh from distant Ophir, rowing home to haven in sunny Palestine, with a cargo of ivory, apes and peacocks, sandalwood, cedarwood, and sweet white wine. That's, you know, the legend of Ophir. I mean, the apes and peacocks come from Kerala. The ivory is from the elephants of Kerala.
Shashi, since we're talking about Kerala, I cannot not ask you about the Kerala story, that contentious, controversial movie. Has that kind of propaganda spread across the state?
No, on the contrary, it was completely and unceremoniously rejected in the state. It really was not just propaganda, it was just blatantly false. It was just an embarrassing. The real Kerala story is a story we've been talking about, a tale of diversity, pluralism, coexistence and harmony, with very, very few exceptions. But the Kerala story of the film alleges that Kerala is this hotbed of Islamic radicalization where 32,000 women have been forcibly converted and made into more or less Mujahideen slaves kind of thing. The whole thing is preposterous. There have been precisely three cases in the entire state of Kerala in which women who were not originally Muslim married Muslim men, were radicalized, and two of them went off to Afghanistan and fought, and the husbands were killed in fighting for ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Taliban or God knows whom. One of these women is still in jail. One family was completely obliterated in American bombing during all we're talking about a few years ago. Well, there are three cases, three, not as the trailer of the film alleged, 32,000. This kind of film is a disservice not only to the false story that it tries to depict, but to the society from which it emerges and to the country where it tries to screen this. So I have to say that it's a real shame. And films that end up with audiences being exhorted to bay for the blood of a particular community and so on is really, really pathetic. So I'm ashamed that such films are made. I'm ashamed that the Film Certification Board has certified them for public screening. But in Kerala, certainly, it had no traction whatsoever. It was unceremoniously kicked out, rejected by the viewers of Kerala.
Shashi, you, as usual, managed to please me. I'm sure the audience as well, and hopefully the gods too. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ranjana. That's very sweet of you. Thanks. Religion was a tool of conquest, twisted to control and divide. Today, it still fuels conflict. The fight for unity is far from over.